When this station presents 1965 in review, you will hear the sound of war in Vietnam.
This is really war.
As always, the sound of politics.
I feel that the Congress in 1965, in practically every instance, is a rubber stamp to the White House.
The sound of rioting in Los Angeles. ...1965 has been a year to remember. A year you will remember when this station presents 1965 in review. ...1965, a year to remember the sounds of war.
This is really war.
The sound of protest.
We are soldiers in the army.
The sound of riots. You'll hear these and many other sounds when this station presents 1965 in review. In review. This is Pye Chamberlain with a review of the sounds, voices, and stories that made news in 1965.
This is really war.
Vietnam, it is really war. For the first time since Korea, Americans are fighting and dying in large numbers overseas. 240 died in a single week of 1965, a greater toll than any week in Korea. America now has about 200,000 men in Vietnam, supplemented by small contingents of Australian and South Korean troops. And as the pressure from the Communist North continues, more will be sent. In the coming year, there may be as many as 500,000 American GIs fighting in the dirty jungle war. Vice President Hubert Humphrey underlined the importance of America's continuing the struggle.
Make no mistake about it. If we weary of our responsibilities, if we don't have the patience and the persevering patience to follow through, the communists have. And we are facing this technique of nibble, nibble, bite, bite, touch, touch, all over the world, and we're going to face it, and that's why we have to take action on occasion that is misunderstood, sometimes purposely.
Against President Johnson's Vietnam policy are lined up not only the Viet Cong guerrillas and North Vietnamese regulars, but a small, if growing, minority of Americans. These include not only the bearded, stringy-haired peace marchers, but aged men, matrons, and even ranking political figures of the president's own Democratic Party. Senator Wayne Morse of Oregon, for example.
No, our record is a sordid and a sorry and a sad one in regard to our unilateral action. We are a complete outlaw in Southeast Asia. We've been an outlaw from the beginning, and so have the communists.
And two Americans made the ultimate protest in 1965. A horrified bystander outside the Pentagon in Washington gave this eyewitness report.
There was a man, and he was shouting something to the crowd. Was unintelligible to me. He's holding a baby in his arms. And the next thing I noticed was that one side of him burst into flames.
Another man burned himself to death in front of the United Nations. President Johnson was stung by the opposition to his policy. He complained,
why don't people concern themselves something with a country that's trying to maintain her independence from aggression.
America tried over and over again for a negotiated settlement, but the communist North Vietnamese and the Red Chinese refused to meet without conditions with U.S. representatives. The massive buildup in Vietnam began to bleed America's standing army at home, and the president was forced to say,
"This will make it necessary to increase our active fighting forces by raising the monthly draft call from 17,000 over a period of time to 35,000.
On the home front, another effect of the war became increasingly evident at year's end. The conflict would require the nation to tighten its belt economically. Some domestic programs would lose money to Vietnam, and the president would have to control the economy more rigidly. He did not seek a legislative hold on wages and prices, but he did use his influence and his gigantic copper and aluminum stockpiles to beat back price hikes in those industries. Overall, America's record prosperity continued, however. It seemed well able to absorb the depressing effect of an increase in the cost of credit imposed by the Federal Reserve Board. And the war increasingly became a political issue. Barry Goldwater recalled,
"Remember, I was called trigger-happy and a warmonger when I suggested doing this 3 years ago."
On Vietnam and most other matters of substance, the United Nations was paralyzed in 1965 by a money dispute. America demanded that Russia, France, and other nations pay their share of peacekeeping operations in the Congo and Middle East, or, under Article 19 of the Charter, lose their vote in the General Assembly. The issue deadlocked the Assembly for months, and the U.S. finally gave up. Our ambassador to the U.N., Arthur Goldberg, said the United States would no longer press the issue, but he warned,
"We must make clear, crystal clear, that if any member can insist on making an exception to the principle of collective financial responsibility with respect to certain activities of the organization, the United States reserves the same option to make exceptions if, in our view, strong and compelling reasons exist for doing so."
1965 in review continues after this message. Vietnam was not the only armed conflict of 1965, and not the only one in which Americans fought. Revolution flared in the Dominican Republic. American Embassy spokesman Malcolm McLean described the chaos.
"There's been very little firing in the city during the night. There are some tanks running around here and there, but not shooting. There's no planes flying overhead. Most people waiting for the dawn. So far, there has been no indication to date of any effort to turn this thing against American nationals or against the American embassy."
But President Johnson said he felt American lives were threatened, and he sent in the Marines. This island nation is next door to Cuba, and the president saw an additional danger of a communist takeover. A few days later, he said,
"We don't propose to sit here in our rocking chair with our hands folded and let the communists set up any government in the Western Hemisphere."
Cuba itself came into the news later this year. Bearded Cuban dictator Fidel Castro suddenly offered to let his people go. Some of them, anyhow. But before formal arrangements could be concluded with the United States, an illegal armada of small vessels left for Cuba to ferry refugees back to Florida. They were breaking State Department rules and risking arrest upon their return. But as one skipper said,
"Now, if the United States thinks that they can deny my freedom for giving other people freedom, well, this is what they're going to have to do. But I'll do it again if I have a chance, but this is what's right.
Finally, the delicate negotiations were completed, and American planes began to fly thousands of dissatisfied Cubans to freedom. America had other foreign problems in 1965, and as usual, there were problems with President de Gaulle of France. Cool in recent years, our relations with France were further chilled when evidence was produced that an American reconnaissance plane had photographed a secret French military installation. De Gaulle had his own problems at home. He was humiliated in December when the French refused him the frank and massive endorsements he asked for in a broadcast political campaign he had hoped he wouldn't need. De Gaulle was forced to obtain his new 7-year term after a degrading runoff election against left-wing candidate François Mitterrand. Still, De Gaulle did stay in. Less fortunate was Ahmed Ben Bella. A bloodless coup threw out the former Algerian premier. Another bloodless military coup deposed Premier Kasavubu of the Congo. In Indonesia, dictator Sukarno was almost knocked out by a communist coup, but the military saved him and started the first purge of communists in that island nation's modern history. In Russia, a mild Kremlin shakeup ousted President Mikoyan. The old Bolshevik was replaced by Nikolai Podgorny, one of the new-look bureaucrats. A full-fledged war was raging on the Indian subcontinent. The disputed territory of Kashmir once again was the object of fighting between India and Pakistan. First came ground skirmishes, then the bombing of major cities. Correspondent John Barton watched the effect on New Delhi.
I saw this capital of India become a capital of darkness tonight, as lights went out all over the city for protection against possible air raids. I also saw many Delhi residents today busy digging deep trenches around their houses to be used in case shelter is needed.
The United Nations Security Council, with the United States and Russia acting in concert for the first time in years, unanimously called for and obtained a ceasefire. The dispute is still not settled, but a shaky truce prevails for the time being. In Africa, new trouble was brewing in Rhodesia. Premier Ian Smith threatened for weeks, then finally acted to break away from Great Britain.
We have struck a blow for the preservation of justice, civilization, and Christianity. And in the spurs of this belief, we have this day assumed our sovereign independence.
Premier Smith drew the wrath of the entire world, except for South Africa, Portugal, and the Portuguese colonies, all of which have similar racial policies. This was the year Pope Paul VI became the first reigning pontiff ever to visit the Americas. He flew to New York to address to the United Nations a plea for peace. He spoke in French.
No more war, never again war. Peace, it is peace which must guide the destinies of peoples and of all mankind.
The Pope spent a long day in New York meeting with President Johnson and celebrating a mass for peace in Yankee Stadium. The Pope's history-making trip to the UN had little visible effect on the remaining business before the world body. He had urged, by implication, that Red China be admitted. But the communist regime was refused entry for the 15th time.
In favor, 47. Against, 47. Abstentions, 20. The proposal, therefore, is not adopted.
It was the closest vote ever, apparently showing a gradual weakening of the opposition to seating Red China. As usual, the UN gained a few members this year, but for the first time in history, it lost one. Sukarno pulled Indonesia out. Later, a disillusioned Cambodia all but pulled out. We'll continue our review of 1965 after this message.
Peace over Congo!
Washington to Watts, the civil rights movement progressed by legislation and demonstration. In Washington, the Voting Rights Bill passed. As federal voting registrars spread through the hardcore segregationist counties of the South, demonstrations continued. In the South, Selma, Alabama was the focus of civil rights demonstrations. Microphones and cameras there recorded the violence as club-swinging police broke up an attempted march from Selma to Montgomery, the state capital. Yet Alabama Governor George Wallace said,
"No one was hit on the ground in Selma, Alabama. Not at all. And only seven, I think, were injured enough to stay any time in the hospital."
A federal court finally told Wallace to permit and protect the march. It was immediately after this five-day journey that white civil rights worker Viola Liuzzo was murdered. Ku Klux Klansman Collie Leroy Wilkins was charged with the slaying. A first all-white jury deadlocked, a second acquitted him. Then in federal court, Wilkins and two other men received 10-year prison terms for violating Mrs. Liuzzo's civil rights. Another civil rights worker, the Reverend James Reeb of Boston, was beaten to death. President Johnson said,
"What happened in Selma was an American tragedy. The blows that were received, the blood that was shed, the life of the good man that was lost, must strengthen the determination of each of us to bring full and equal and exact justice to all of our people."
The jury system of the South became the next target of the Johnson administration, as the president called for legislation
that is clear in its purpose and specific in its aim. And that aim is to prevent injustice to Negroes at the hands of all white juries.
Soon after this appeal, a white man was convicted of a racial murder by a Southern all-white jury for the first time in modern history. Hubert Strange was found guilty of slaying foundry worker Willie Brewster. The violence of Selma was eclipsed by an incredible week of full-scale rioting in Los Angeles. The arrest of a Negro motorist touched off terrorism, sniping and looting in the black ghetto called the Watts District. Governor Brown had to call out the National Guard.
"This tragedy is now being prolonged by hit-and-run hoodlums and terrorists. This is now a case of guerrilla fighting with gangsters. I want it clearly understood that the Guard will remain here in force until the streets of Los Angeles are safe."
Around the country in 1965, a new type of demonstration came of age. The protest for peace.
"Sing with me. We are soldiers in the army.
The demonstrators were mostly young people, and mostly the same ones who marched for civil rights last year. There were sit-ins on Capitol Hill, and for the first time in history, a sit-in at the White House.
"We are soldiers in the army. We have to fight it, although we have..."
It was also a year of familiar protest by labor against management. A maritime strike tied up East and Gulf Coast shipping. Two aerospace strikes threatened the space program for a while. The New York papers were closed down again by a combination strike and lockout. The biggest threat of all to industry was a looming steel strike. But President Johnson got both sides up to the White House, and after a week of tough bargaining and presidential arm twisting, they settled. Legislatively, the famous Texas twist was most in evidence. On Capitol Hill, correspondent John Chambers reports.
"So many members of the 89th Congress owe President Lyndon Johnson their political life that the first session was his from beginning to end. What dissent there was came primarily over foreign policy. In a speech for Negro equality, the president made his most dramatic appeal to Congress.
On this issue, there must be no delay or no hesitation are no compromise with our purpose.
Progress was slow, but by summer, the voter rights law of 1965 was written, and Mr. Johnson made a special trip, one of several, for bill signings, this one to the Capitol to sign the voter rights law. Before it passed, the Congress voted to cut the excise taxes imposed during the Korean War. Congress approved a revolutionary medical care for the aged law, a hospital care plan financed under Social Security and a voluntary program. The first session gave Lyndon Johnson a new cabinet officer to head a new housing and urban development department, made it a federal crime to assassinate a president or vice president, and asked the states to approve a presidential disability and succession constitutional amendment, and even gave Mrs. Johnson a treasure, the Highway Beautification Law. It went along with the desilvering of coins, and it approved a complete change in immigration laws. Right up to the end, President Johnson and House Republican leader Gerald Ford fought.
I feel that the Congress in 1965, in practically every instance, is a rubber stamp to the White House. The Congress today, the legislative branch in Washington, does not work its own will, does not exercise any independence. They are purely an adjunct to the executive branch of the government, and as a consequence, I fear in the long run the loss of freedom and the loss of some of the heritage of our American system.
We continue our review of 1965 in a moment. Taken to ease the shock of the announcement. But still the nation and the world worried when presidential spokesman Bill Moyers announced,
"The doctors recommended that the gallbladder be removed. The president, therefore, will enter Bethesda Naval Hospital Thursday night for surgery Friday."
The operation was a complete success, but there were several hours of uncertainty during which Vice President Humphrey was in charge. What kind of a day was it for him?
"I think everything's gone very well, sir."
"How would you describe your day, sir?"
"Just an ordinarily busy day, just as we generally have."
Despite the success of the removal of the president's gallbladder and a kidney stone, it took the chief executive the rest of the year to recover. He spent almost 2 months at his Texas ranch. As Mr. Johnson regained his strength there, the nation was shocked to hear that former President Eisenhower was seriously ill. He suffered a third heart attack. But he was recovering quickly, and he promised to be back on the golf course soon. This year, as every year, the world lost many of its outstanding personalities. Sir Winston Churchill, an American citizen as well as a British subject. America's statesman and ambassador to the world, Adlai Stevenson. Former Vice President Henry Wallace. Former South Korean President Syngman Rhee. And many others whose names made political, social, and cultural history. Several major disasters also took lives this year. There were killer plane crashes in New York, Lake Michigan, Salt Lake City, Cincinnati, Hong Kong, and Paris. Hurricane Betsy ripped up Florida and Louisiana. Killer tornadoes and floods hit the Midwest while the Northeast thirsted for enough water to survive. A cruise ship burned and sank between Florida and Bermuda, killing about 90 fun-seeking passengers. A volcano erupted near Manila, its deadly lava rolling over the land, destroying everything in its path. A major disaster that might have been was the terrifying blackout of northeastern America, while a moonlit night and the almost incredible composure of New York prevented widespread tragedy, the power failure pointed up America's increasing dependence on electricity and automatic devices. Nowhere are automatic devices more important than in the transistorized mazes of Cape Kennedy and the Houston Space Center, and in the rockets and manned capsules they hurl into space. And in 1965, the devices worked pretty well, enabling the United States to end the year with history's first rendezvous between two orbiting spaceships. This was the year a Russian astronaut took the first walk in outer space. Russia also sent several instrument packages to the moon, but their attempted soft landings failed. France became the third nation to orbit a satellite with its own rocket. America took close-up pictures of the moon and Mars and continued to build its worldwide communications network. But America's most spectacular efforts were steps in the Gemini program, our stairway to the moon. Gemini 3 with astronauts Gus Grissom and John Young became America's first two-man space flight. Then in June came Gemini 4 with space twins McDivitt and White up for 62 orbits, slightly under 98 hours. It was here an American first walked in space. This was the conversation as Ed White floated outside the Gemini spaceship. White is taking pictures of the ship when McDivitt says,
"Let me take a close-up picture. You smeared up my windshield, you dirty dog." "Yeah, but... I don't even know exactly where we are, but it looks like we're about over Texas again."
White enjoyed his walk in space so much that it took a direct order from the ground to get him back in the spaceship. In August, Gemini 5 carried astronauts Cooper and Conrad around the world 120 times in almost 191 hours for a new endurance record. But here there was a partial failure. Because of fuel cell trouble, they had to cancel attempts to rendezvous with an instrument pod.
"Be advised, there will be no, I say again, there will be no Olmes burns over the States. We will not attempt to rendezvous with the rep." Affirmative.
Later, the fuel cell problem did clear up, and space officials did put Gemini 5 through maneuvers to rendezvous with the Phantom Agena rocket. In theory, anyhow, this proved that the space chase could be completed successfully. A rendezvous attempt with a real Agena rocket scheduled for Gemini 6 didn't get far before there was a failure, and astronauts Stafford and Schirra heard these words.
"The mission has been scrubbed. We have scrubbed the mission for the day. Because Carnarvon is not acquired, we can assume the Atlas, the Agena vehicle, went into the Atlantic some 5,500 miles short of the desired velocity."
Gemini 6 was rescheduled as a part of a year-end space spectacular, Gemini 76. 7 was to orbit first, then a week or so later they'd send off Gemini 6 and the two would meet in space. But on the first attempt to launch 6, we heard...
5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
"Now we've got a shutdown. No liftoff. The engines have shut down."
The shot was aborted, but 3 days later it lifted off on schedule, and 5.5 hours after that, the four astronauts and two spacecraft were close enough to look through the ports and see each other as they flew nose to nose.
"Standing by, if you have anything for us."
At one point, Schirra saw something hanging from the Gemini 7 capsule.
"Where are they hanging from?" "Oh, Frank, it looks like they picked up at the separation plate. It might be the fiberglass. It's approximately 10 to 15 feet long."
"The separation plane for the booster, right?"
"Affirmative."
"That's exactly where you have one, too."
And so it went on as the two craft flew around each other with the spacemen talking and snapping pictures. If the accomplishments of the United States in space during 1965 seem to recall the days of Buck Rogers, even they seem to pale alongside the flurry of reports of unidentified flying objects, or as some call them, flying saucers. The reports came from many places throughout the Mid and Southwest, like this report from Deputy Sheriff Everett Tucker of Wellington, Kansas.
"Got a call out of Wichita and said it had been confirmed on these objects, and my wife and I were out on the roof, and we did see this object to the east. And it was a big round flame, you know, and there was vapor going out the back, but it looked like fire, not vapor smoke. And it was a long ways off, but it's pretty big. It was enormous. It had to be, because it looked about like a horse tank from where I seen it."
Space officials called it ridiculous. But was it mass hypnosis, overactive imagination, an experimental spacecraft, or a new military weapon? Was it theirs or ours? Or was it really a visitor from outer space? Who's to know? With everything else that happened in 1965, almost anything is believable. This has been 1965 in Review, a production of the United Press International Audio Network, produced and directed by Fred Dressler. This is Pye Chamberlain